Casper Citron from the Algonquin Hotel, a landmark on West 44th Street in New York City. I'd like to welcome back to the program, it's been about a year and many times before that, John Houseman, who has written an autobiography, the only criticism of which I have is that it stops in 1941, but obviously there'll be another act to it. It's called Run Through. Talking with John Houseman is Sam Lev, who was a designer for the first two shows of the Mercury Theater. And I can't think of a better place to start than sort of in the center about the Mercury Theater. Those that have grown up since or been born since, this was a repertory theater that was started in the 30s, John?
It was started in 1937.
In 37, and lasted really one full season with four tremendous successes, and the fifth play went, and so did the theater.
Yes, it altogether, and as a theater, it lasted almost 2 years. And then the name continued on the radio show, and Austin used the name on his motion pictures. But as a repertory theater in New York City, it lasted a little less than 2 years.
This was really one of the early attempts to succeed in a repertory theater, and it's really too bad that your finances weren't handled in a more different way. It might still be around.
Well, I don't really think that's what blew us up. I think, ironically, it was our success that finally destroyed us. We had become so successful after the first year, and all kinds of temptations, radio shows, motion picture contracts, and other things arrived. And I think we began to disperse our attention and our love into so many channels that the theater itself went by the board. And I think it was very sad. I think the theater could have survived if that had been our only interest.
Sam, how did you react to these parts and Run Through when you think back to your role as designer of those first two shows 35 years ago?
Of course, when I was called in to do the job for the Mercury Theater by a very fine woman, Jean Rosenthal. We went to school together. Jeannie had known Orson Welles and John Houseman from Federal Theater. I was on Federal Theater also.
You weren't in the Black Federal Theater?
No.
Like they were.
I did several shows in the Yiddish Theater, and also a show called Big Blow, which was done right across the street from the Mercury Theater, the Maxine Elliott Theater. Now, Jeannie called me in. She introduced me to Orson Welles and John Houseman. And I was told they had only about $5,000 to do the entire production with.
That was right. That was, in fact, rather a high figure. I'm surprised we told you that.
That was even small for those days.
Oh, yes. And Jeannie said we have to do the show with very, very simple effects. So we walked into the Mercury Theater, which was then called
The Comedy Theater.
And the backstage looked very bisymmetric. And we spoke about using the back wall of the stage for the background for Julius Caesar. And we arrived at painting the wall. I said, if we expect to paint a wall, we better call in house painters now, because scenic painters will cost us much more money. House painters were paid $8 a day, while scenic painters were paid $18 a day. Now, it was perfectly all right for me to call in house painters because I was not a member of the union yet. Now, later on, when we did another show, and we wanted to paint the back wall of the Billy Rose Theater, I said, we can't call in house painters. We have to call in scenic painters because I was already a member of the union.
That is mentioned in the book, as a matter of fact. As I remember it, about halfway through the preparation of Julius Caesar, we did have to switch from house painters to scenic painters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in relation to today's costs, all this is such peanuts, is so pathetically small. But, of course, I think it's the reason why the Depression era was, in a way, such an exciting era, because everybody was thinking in much more economical and organic terms than the way we think today, where we're immediately in tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You know, it's sort of frightening to think of those early days of the Mercury Theater and then the War of the Worlds on the air, which is the Mercury Theater on the air, to think that Orson Welles, your partner at that time, was like 19 years old.
He was 19.
How old were you then, John?
I was 12 years older than he.
So that you, even you were young, but he was just unbelievable.
He was a boy, but he was a very precocious boy. Now, he was actually 19 when we went up to Harlem, and he did the Negro Macbeth. Mm-hmm. I was just over 30.
Well, how did people in the theater feel? Never mind how you felt, because you got along with them more or less. But how did older people in the theater feel about Orson, you know, giving out orders the way he did? He wasn't exactly a diplomat at age of 19.
Well, it was, and I think that Sammy would confirm this, since he actually had to work with him. I think there was a combination of amazement at this peculiar phenomenon, this very tall and even then quite large young man who we knew was only 19, but who talked and thought and behaved like a man of full maturity. As I think I say in run-through in the book, one really had the impression that he had almost been born and with his mother's milk had absorbed an enormous amount of theatrical knowledge, so that one was never dealing with an immature boy in theatrical terms. He may have in his emotional life, in his personal things, but as far as the theater was concerned, you were always dealing with a man of enormous instinctive experience.
In the early days, when I first met him, I just couldn't get myself to call him Orson. I had to call him Mr. Welles, because I thought
at
he was
age
much
19.
Older. I thought he was much older than me. Now, I was also not 12 years older. I was 5 or 6 years older than Orson was, but I just couldn't get myself to call him Orson. I could call Mr. Houseman Jack, but I couldn't call Orson. I had to call him Mr. Welles. Later on, of course, when I got to know him a little bit better, it was Orson, and he called me Sam.
Was it in the play, your play, Sam, Caesar, that Orson was having a scene where inadvertently someone got stabbed? Was that Julius Caesar, or was that another?
No, that was Julius Caesar. Sammy was off.
Sam doesn't remember that.
Brighter pastures by that time.
Yes.
But no, it was Julius Caesar, and it did happen, and
theater of reality.
It could have had hideous results, because actually it was a very sharp knife, and the incision was not a big one, but it just happened to hit an artery, and the Joe Holland, the man to whom it happened, was totally unaware of this. He was playing Julius Caesar, and in the fatal stabbing, et tu, Brute, this sharp knife went in, as I say, about, must have been a half an inch, not more. And he lay there, totally unaware himself that he had been wounded, until the people surrounding the corpse of Julius Caesar began to slip. And it was peculiar that they should slip, since there was no water on the stage, and looking down, they discovered that, in fact, what they were slipping in was a pool of blood. And so being good theater men and knowing that the show must go on, they continued the scene, perhaps hurrying it a little bit towards its final line. And then as soon as the lights went out, they rushed him out in a cab and took him to the hospital.
Well, what I couldn't quite understand, John Houseman, was why Orson Welles would be using a real...
Well, that was one of those things.
One of the Orson Welles things.
All the other conspirators used
rubber daggers.
With which they could pound him to their heart's content without harm. Orson, and I think his thinking was that since he was very far downstage, and since the final stabbing by Brutus is the high spot of the murder, he felt that the light dazzling on a beautiful steel blade was more effective than on a rubber blade, no matter how well simulated. But I think after this event, he did revert to a rubber blade.
Jack, I don't mean to embarrass you, but please allow me to say the following. Of course, after we worked very closely together, knowing that Orson was the director, there was always a feeling within me there was a watchful eye of someone else, and this was Jack Houseman. Mm-hmm. always, as the saying goes in our book in the Talmud, there was always a watchful eye, a listening ear, and everything which was done was recorded. And the result is this book, there is the record.
Mm-hmm. Sam, did you by any chance hear this landmark radio show of all time, War of the Worlds, when it was on?
Oh, yes. I was on another show then, outside of Orson Welles' production, but this was something sensational. Front page of the New York Times, Orson Welles' show invades the world.
Did you actually hear it, Sammy?
No, I didn't hear it. I only heard repercussions later. I saw the newspaper items.
I was trying to remember. I thought I'd heard it. I don't remember. I know I didn't panic, but I used to listen to a lot of radio. John, perhaps to some of our younger generation, you might synopsize a bit about the War of the Worlds, because a lot of people probably weren't born.
Well, it was a unique phenomenon, although it did happen later once again in South America. But in fact, we had not the slightest notion that this kind of thing was going to result from the show. We decided we had done a certain amount of adventure, a certain amount of romance. We'd done a love story. We'd even done Julius Caesar on the radio show. And we decided the time had come to do a science fiction show. And we hesitated between The Purple Cloud, which is a famous science fiction show by Michael Shield, and The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. And we chose the latter. And this was written just like any other of the weekly radio shows we did, without any notion of its being a contemporary show. Then it seemed rather boring. It seemed rather dull. So we decided to update it and make it happen today. And this, perhaps, we felt would spice up the show a little bit. And once we started doing that, once the writers began to do that, the whole show began to get a little more exciting. And little by little, as the show went into production, everybody began to enjoy the topicality of it. And on the final day, when Orson arrived and took over the show as director, producer, this was very strong. In the studio, the actors themselves seemed to come under the spell of this rather exciting event, but it was still just a radio show. The fact that it panicked the entire nation, and that for a while it really looked as though a great many hundreds of people had been injured and even killed in the panics resulting from this radio show, did not even occur to us. It was a terrible surprise, and it happened when we were about 30 minutes into the show on the air, and suddenly the switchboards at the CBS began to be flooded with inquiries, protests, complaints from all over the country, that we realized that the joke had really become fairly monumental.
Has it ever been the actual show been replayed?
Well, that's very curious. It has, and I don't quite know why or how. I'd always assumed, it existed. It was taken off the air on acetates, and there was the days before tape. And we took all our shows off the air, and, of course, the network kept a record of the show. Immediately after the show, CBS, alarmed at the reaction, tried to get back all the copies of the show and to lock them up because they were afraid of lawsuits and various things. Over the years, I've always had a copy of it, and I know Orson has had a copy of it. There must have been many others made, because quite recently, about a year and a half ago, some commercial outfit got hold of one of these, or combined several of the best preserved of these, and did actually make a commercial record of the War of the Worlds. I don't know how they got around the union problems and paying the salaries and all that, but in fact I suppose it's so long ago that the statute of limitations prevailed, and you can today buy the War of the Worlds as a commercial recording, and it's very impressive even today, simply as a radio show. It was a wonderfully paced and wonderfully contrived radio show, even without believing these impossible events, which of course took place, could not have taken place in reality in less than about 3 or 4 days, and took place on the air in about 35 minutes. In spite of that discrepancy, it still kind of gives you a chill to listen to that show.
How many parts would Orson play in the typical Mercury Theatre presentation?
Well, he would rarely play more than two, but he had devised a thing on which he and I worked, which was a sort of special kind of narration. When the show was first offered to Orson by the Columbia Broadcasting System, it was called First Person Singular. And all the shows were narrated by Wells. This sometimes meant shifting the script around in such a way that he always played or tended to play the leading character and also told the story. For instance, in Treasure Island, he was the boy who tells the story in the Stevenson book, but the boy, many years later, remembering what happened. Then he also played Long John Silver. So he had a ball on those shows, and of course his voice was so flexible and he was so versatile as a radio actor that he was able to do this. Very few other actors could have done it.
Sam Lev, when you think back, I asked you earlier about the 35 years in between now and the Mercury Theatre, the chaos and the all the wild scenes that took place with the Mercury Theatre productions, is that typical theater, or has that all gone into limbo and today things are more orderly?
Well, it all depends on the director. It all depends on the production. If the director is sensible and intelligent, he tries to do away with the chaos. He tries to make order, to have order. Now, Orson was a very, very theatrical individual. And that kind of, the thing which we call chaos was not chaos at the Mercury Theater. It was just a dramatic presentation of how to do a play.
Yes, but they didn't open on time. The previews were canceled with the audience sitting there. I mean, those things don't often happen.
But that didn't really matter. That was all kind of part of the fun. As long as we were small and young and experimental, even the audiences that were abused kind of enjoyed this. They never quite knew when they came to the Mercury what they were in for. And I really believe that as long as we were rising, as long as we were coming up, this was almost a virtue. And I entirely agree with what Sammy has just said. That chaos, it was chaos, but it was also a dramatic presentation. As I think I mentioned in the book, there were two dramas always going on. In one of our productions, there was the drama of the show itself, which would finally be presented to the public, and there was the drama of how to get it on. And Orson particularly sort of encouraged this. And he's not alone in this. I've seen other directors do this. If you create a situation where everything is desperate, everything is hopeless, and the great man, by sheer willpower, imagination, authority, and genius, finally succeeds in melding all this chaos into a finished production, it makes the finished production more exciting. It's a little like in a circus where the man almost falls off the rope, or pretends almost to fall off the rope, so as to make it more exciting when he finally makes it. I think there was a lot of that.
As far as I'm concerned, working with Orson, he was very, very organized. He knew exactly where he was going. When we used to have meetings, he used to come prepared to the meetings with little sketches, little drawings. As Jack says in his book, he came around with plasticine model. He used to stay home and play with things so he could explain to the people working with him exactly what he wanted. He knew what he wanted. And our job, my job in this production was not so much as creative, but mostly, let's use the word interpretive. It was mostly his idea, and we had to concretize it, so to speak. We had to make it work. Jeannie and I had to make it practical, so to speak. But most of the ideas that I was concerned with in Julius Caesar and in Shoemaker's Holiday came from Orson. He may have spoken to Jack Houseman before or to someone else, but when I met with him, he knew exactly where he was going. Well, we submitted many ideas to him, which he discarded and accepted. This is part of the working together on any production. But he knew where he was going. He was organized, terribly organized.
Well, he may have been organized, but John Houseman, tell us about the disorganized state of, I think it was the final Mercury production, when you had 600 or 700 people seated outside till 10 or 11 o'clock, and what you did about it.
Well, that was actually not Austin's fault at all or Austin's responsibility. The truth is that one of the penalties of operating on as minuscule a budget as we did was that we were not able to afford high-class machinery. And in Danton's death, which had its own problems, which I've also mentioned in the book...
Which ruined Mercury.
Which sort of broke us, yes. Yeah. But there were many problems, and one of them was this elevator, which Austin had devised. Now, an elevator is a very expensive piece of machinery. Jeannie Rosenthal, who was a genius at doing things on a shoestring, had devised a kind of elevator shaft, which always terrified me because it sort of waved around, and Jeannie used to explain to me that that's why it was safe, because it wasn't rigid, and the very fact that it could wave around gave it a kind of flexibility, which I never quite believed. Anyhow, on the day of our, I think it was our second or third preview, this contrived elevator broke down. And, no, as a matter of fact, it was worse than that. Actually, it fell down during a dress rehearsal.
One of the cast broke their leg.
Yes. One of the cast broke their leg. It was a minor incident, but an unfortunate one. Anyhow, there it was, and the thing was being repaired. And we invited our audience, our paying audience, to a preview, and we needed by that time every penny that that preview audience was paying to see the show. And when curtain time came, the elevator had not yet been fixed. And I asked Jean Rosenthal, and she said, oh, I think it'll probably be done in about half an hour. Well, we'd kept audiences waiting much longer than that before, so we didn't take it too seriously. About 20 minutes went by, and I said, how are we coming? She said, not well at all. I think it's going to be about another 20 or 25 minutes. So after the audience had quite happily waited about 35 or 40 minutes, we decided something should be done. Austin said, let's give them their money back and send them home. And I said, we can't give them the money back because we haven't got it, so they've got to stay. So then 10 minutes after that, Orson Welles and Martin Gable, dressed in their high collars and knickerbockers of the revolutionary period, went out and in front of the curtain performed the tent scene from Julius Caesar, which had been one of the high spots of Julius Caesar the year before. And the audience kind of enjoyed that and applauded, and that kept them quiet for about another 20 or 25 minutes. I then said to Jean Rosenthal, how's the elevator? And she said, it's going to be another 15 or 20 minutes. Orson again said, give them their money back. I said, we haven't got it. So he went into his dressing room and slammed the door and sulked. We waited another 10 minutes, and the audience by this time was really getting a little bit restless, and they were clapping a little bit and stamping their feet. So I went out in front of the curtain, and I started to make a genial and, I thought, humorous speech in which I explained our problem, and I said that I was giving them two choices. Either they could go home now, they'd been very patient, and the stub that they had in their hand for the preview would be good at any subsequent performance. Or they could, if they preferred, they could remain and wait a little longer, and we hoped all would be well. And while I was making this speech, I felt myself poked in the back, and through the slit in the curtain, a hand, a very small hand, came out with a little white card. And surreptitiously, I read the white card, and it said, sorry, darling, no show tonight. This was awkward because I was right in the middle of this extraordinary speech of mine in which I'd given them this unusual choice. So I had a moment of absolute panic, and then quite instinctively, without really thinking, I leapt off the stage and went up the aisle, got a hold of the doorman and the house manager. I said, open all the doors, open everything. I came back. It couldn't have taken more than 15 or 20 seconds. I came back, vaulted onto the stage, and said, literally, ladies and gentlemen, a vote has been taken, and it is overwhelmingly in favor of returning on another night. And so I bid you all good evening and thank you very much, and disappeared behind the curtain. And the audience was so hypnotized that they rose, left the theater, and I don't know how many of them or how long it took them to realize that no vote whatever had been taken. And this was a very instructive lesson in the democratic process. I assumed, and they accepted the assumption, that a vote had been taken, though in fact no vote could possibly have been taken in 15 seconds.
You know, it was right after that, when the production was not successful, that Mercury had to fold. And you said in Run Through, John Houseman, that you really weren't too upset at that point.
Well, in retrospect, of course, one is upset because here was the great hope of the American theater, a young, vital repertory company functioning successfully in New York City on Broadway. And after the first year, we were hailed as the saviors of the American theater. And here we were 4 months later, 5 months later, closing our doors and throwing in the sponge. But in fact, we were so busy. We were doing an hour radio show every week. And by this time, we'd been sold to Campbell's Soups. And we were making an enormous amount of money, and we'd become a kind of a national figure. Orson was on the cover of Time, had huge interviews in every newspaper in the country. And the general atmosphere of hectic success was such that we really didn't have time to be upset. I think if nothing else had been going, we would have been suicidal. But so much was going on. Hell was popping on all sides, economically, in terms of publicity, in terms of everything, in terms of offers of motion pictures and hopes for the future, that at the time it just seemed an unfortunate setback in a great burst of success. And it was only much later that one looks back with some sadness and some self-reproach on the failure of the Mercury Theatre to supply New York with a repertory company, which we're still struggling with at this very moment.
What we haven't had a chance to talk about, which is tremendously interesting and run through, is the Federal Theatre and the Black Theatre, which you were involved with, what, about 8 or 9 months, was it? Or?
Well, no. I was actually up there about 13 months. Orson came up a little later. He came up to do Macbeth, so he was only there about 8 or 9 months. Mm-hmm. It was an important landmark, although its immediate effects were not perceptible for a long time. I do think it broke certain taboos about the performances of black actors in non-black plays, in the classics. Broke certain inhibitions that existed, such as that there were no such thing. There was no such thing as good black stagehands, and whereas in fact they were wonderful stagehands who had been in fact excluded from the commercial theater for years, and were still excluded for another 20 years after the Federal Theater folded. But at least the precedent had been made.
Thank you very much, John Houseman and Sammy Lev, for talking about Run Through, a memoir by John Houseman, published by Simon & Schuster. I hope there'll be a second volume. I'd love to hear what happened the last 31 years, John. Thank you for coming by. And from the Algonquin Hotel in New York, a landmark, this is Caspar Citrin saying goodbye.